You're listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And tonight we're going to be talking about the latest, the sort of final-ish sort of episode of Doctor Who, which is called something like Don't Blink, or the Flesh and Stone of the Angels Will Take Manhattan in Time, or some nonsense like that. I don't know. Angels Take Manhattan.
Don't blink while looking at the Statue of Liberty.
Actually, though, we are going to talk about that, but I am going to derail this conversation, and I want to talk about something else first that Ben knows nothing about. So,
oh.
It's... Well, you sort of know about it, but you don't know I wanted to talk about this particular topic. Some of you may know, although I haven't really advertised it very much, so the likelihood of you knowing it is fairly slim, that during the course of Series 7, which we're just going to call it Series 7 for the moment, I have minutes after each viewing, first viewing of a Doctor Who episode, I have recorded an audio boo over at audioboo.fm and username Fusion Patrol, if you're interested in hearing them, of my reaction to the episode immediately after it. I mean, if I watched it live, then I got on there and recorded it within 20 minutes. Sometimes I kind of recorded it a few times. But for the most part, it's just very, very raw gut reaction. And I did this as an experiment because... typically, what we do here at Fusion Patrol Central is we record on Wednesday nights. And so you watch Doctor Who on Saturday, you have a couple days to percolate in the back of the mind, and we
rewatch the episode, get
possibly
details,
watch it, right, think about it, start humbling about it. And I'm kind of wondering was how drastically my opinion was changing about these episodes, because if you listen to our review of these, I've liked almost every one of these episodes this year, but if you listen to our reviews, we sound like we hate them. And that's really not the case. There's just lots of little things that are annoying about
them. We harp on the negatives.
Yes, and I wanted to catch my impression at the time and then come back and then listen to the podcast and see how it has mutated in just 3 days, basically. And so what I wanted to talk about was, I haven't even formulated the question correctly, but I mean, does overanalyzing these episodes diminish the enjoyment of it, of the program? And are we being too, yes. Are we, as we were accused of being Statler and Waldorf-ish?
Thank you, Simon.
Yes. So that's an open question. I put it to you. I mean, I definitely, you know, there are things in my audio boos that right after the episode, I hated the stone circle in A Town Called Mercy. They're just, you know, stupid. And I mean, it hit me as stupid as I was watching the episode. But, and the whiny bit. But, you know, I enjoyed Angels Take Manhattan, and I don't even know if I mentioned it, but I was the only thing that really outraged me when I watched it the first time through, really outraged me, was the stupid Statue of Liberty nonsense. This just beyond, you know, they've done, to me, I know you'll disagree with this, but I mean, they've done three progressively extra stupid things in the last three episodes. I mean, egregiously stupid, compounding stupid on top of stupid each time. And those were the stone circle around Mercy, the black boxes, and the Statue of Liberty. I mean, they're just like...
I'll give you 2 out of 3.
I know you wouldn't like that, but I don't think that you can divorce the beginning of the black boxes from the utterly incomprehensibly stupid ending of the black boxes.
Well, that,
I have to take them as a holistic whole and say the black boxes...
I gotta get you.
That was
yes.
Just my... Okay, so it's like those things have hit me about the episodes, and as I watched them whenever they came out, you know, but otherwise, you know, great smooth sailing, like, you know, liked it, speaking for myself, and So I wanted to put that to you. I mean, do you feel like you like them less as you think about them more?
Oh, boy. I would say that in the case of this episode, the more I thought about it, the more I liked it.
Interesting.
I actually grew to like this episode more. I still have my nitpicks about it. And maybe I would feel entirely differently if I had watched it again. I am simply going on remembering my viewing experience, remembering the things I saw, remembering some of the story aspects as I watched the episode the first time. And by not watching it a second time, I think what's happened is that the good elements sort of rose to the surface. And the bad stuff is just like sediment. It just kind of sunk to the bottom. I mean, it's still there, but what am I remembering more fondly? You know, obviously the good stuff. So from that point of view, I think the more that I think about the episode, the more I remember the positive about it. Now, I cannot make that claim with every episode. Mm-hmm. I still detest Dinosaurs on a Spaceship. I mean, the more I think about it, the more nauseated I become with that episode.
That's right. We didn't really get the whole podcast. I did that one with Simon.
But I did get to express my opinion. I think it was
the next week.
The following week, I did get to have my say on that. And the more I think about that one, just the uglier it became.
Interesting.
But with the other episodes, I would say that my opinion remained static. It was totally static. It never changed. The more I thought about it, I mean, I had my initial reaction, and then over the time as I digested the episodes, as I know you do and as I do, I found that with Asylum of the Daleks, Dinosaurs on a Spaceship, A Town Called Mercy, Power of Three, I found that with each of these episodes, my opinion really didn't waver all that much. It didn't change. This was the first one, the first episode to do that.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, let's talk about this episode. Angels Take Manhattan. Of course, I'll throw out another question here. Does advanced hype diminish your enjoyment of the story?
Yes, it did.
Okay.
That it definitely did, because and I get so irritated every single time when Stephen Moffat just gets onto Twitter or whatever and says, "There will be tears." Oh, for crying out loud, don't say that.
You know, I don't know how many – I don't remember him saying that one. But I mean, apart from this one, obviously he did. But, there have been other instances like, you know, a character's really going to die or stuff like that where the hype builds up and then, you know, what he said didn't happen. Now, in this case – there will be tears. Okay, I didn't cry.
I did.
The kids didn't cry. My wife didn't cry. But we actually know people who cried.
I know people who did cry, yes.
So, you know, are we – you know, he's written a story that will affect some people. I mean, I have cried. I have cried at movies. I will admit this in The Search for Spock when the Enterprise burned up. I cried.
You're the only one.
And, you know, that was like a dear character to me. And it wasn't a big cry, I didn't sob, but became a little tear here. And that was more than I expected by any stretch of the imagination, more than I expected. And that's the question. If I'd been expecting it, would I have had a deeper emotional or less deep emotional? There will be tears. Well.
Well, I think the question needs to be
– it didn't seem that deep to me.
No,
you know?
No.
I thought it was a happy ending for them.
Thank you.
See, that's the thing. It was a happy ending except for the doctor.
It was a happy ending. The question becomes – and I think, you know, we'll get into more of the details as we discuss it. But the question becomes – and I would like to ask Mr. Moffat this. Where in the story did you expect me to shed tears? Because I think I know at which part of the story – and it's not like what maybe so many other people would have assumed, which is when we finally say goodbye to the Ponds.
You're thinking it's when they're going to jump off?
Yep. Only because, and I don't want to go into that right. I don't want to go into too much detail right now. I kind of want to get to that as the course of the discussion. But I kind of think that maybe was the scene that maybe Mr. Moffat was referring to, because I agree with you. I think this episode actually had a happy ending.
You know, considering they have shifted the Russell T. Davies, I'll blame it on him, but Moffat has continued it. He has no choice, really. If you look at classic Doctor Who, with the exception of Romana, and to some degree even Romana, the companions and the Doctor have had a paternal relationship. He has been like a father to them. Even Peter Davison was a more of a father figure to the companions.
Oh, yes.
Than he was a partner. And, you know, you can take that romantically or non-romantically or whatever, but since Rose, the companion has had a much
more. It's been more of a, almost romantic.
Nobody is going to, nobody would leave. Nobody would leave the Doctor. They set up characters who are in this position who just would not leave. And if they did leave, it would be an ugly, nasty affair. And I mean affair, but it would be like
it would be a bad deal.
It would like a breakup, and it would not happen like it did with Tegan Jovanka, just suddenly, I just can't take this anymore, and leaving, kind of thing.
Or
it would
Joe
build
Grant.
Up, and it would build up, and it would, yeah. And it would
Joe,
build up.
Joe Grant is a classic case. I mean, she goes off, she marries the one scientist in that mushroom commune, or Liz Shaw, who just left. I mean, what happened to the good old days? Or Leela, she decides she wants to stay on Gallifrey. Yeah, or Romana wants to stay in eSpace. I mean, Keith and I had the same discussion. I mean, I'm really tired, and I do blame Russell Davies for this. And yes, I think Moffat has continued the tradition, and I really dislike it.
Why it's tough not to once they've done it, though. I mean, unless they get an older doctor, this is probably going to continue. Which what I get to is it makes it extremely difficult for them to write a convincing story as to how the Doctor isn't just going to keep coming back to his companions. And, Rose, they had to put her in another universe. And and that was not a happy ending. And they still brought her back and gave her a happy ending, which ticked me off. And
I would have been happier if they just kept the unhappy ending.
Right. It would have been better. Donna had an unhappy ending because she loses her memory and goes off and lives happily ever after. Wait. Well, anyway.
It's an unhappy ending in that she totally forgets the Doctor. Totally. I mean, the only one who didn't have a bad ending in the current incarnation was Martha Jones.
Really, kind of, yeah.
She voluntarily walked out because she knew that she wasn't going to get anything out of that relationship.
Which made her the smartest one of the bunch. But
it did.
Anyway, so, once again, we're presented with Amy and Rory, and not only have they, been traveling with a Doctor, and why would they leave, but they've also established they don't even have to, because
Brian,
they can just keep coming back and over again and for the rest of their lives.
Rory's father even gave them his blessing, go out, travel, when are you ever going to experience this again?
And here's the other thing that causes this problem. In classic Doctor Who, like the Doctor could ever land the TARDIS where he needed it to be. If you go back to the very early ones with Ian and Barbara, he spent their entire time trying to get them back to Earth in 1963.
I never could.
And when he finally did, they had to get off. It's like, we better get off the TARDIS now.
And
we'll
they
never
left.
Have a chance.
And for anybody who actually saw that final episode, when they got off, I mean, the final scenes with them were on a bus, and they were happy as two pigs in mud.
So we have a difficult episode here.
We
have to say goodbye to Amy, and we have to do it in such a way that they can't come back, and or convincingly can't come back, or the Doctor just keep pop into their lives over and over again and keep going. And this is a typical situation, and it's just going to get worse with every new companion that they bring along, I think. They're going to have a harder and harder time not repeating trapped in another universe, trapped in a place where I can't get to with a TARDIS. So these are the difficulties coming into this episode. That's why I wanted to touch on that, because this episode has to fulfill that very difficult task of doing it.
And yet it was totally unnecessary.
Yeah. Okay, so the episode, for those who haven't seen it, why are you listening to this then?
Spoilers!
Doctor in New York, Weeping Angels, Contemporary Weeks, maybe?
Present day, I'm guessing.
2012. They specifically state 2012, which I have a question about. But Rory gets zapped by the Weeping Angels, back to 1938. The Doctor and Amy, through the medium of finding out about it in a book. Note my displeasure there.
Mm-hmm.
Go back to 1938, find Rory, find the angels, find out what nefarious plan the angels are doing, see Rory die again and again.
And again.
And again. And, yeah. And River's there. God, they write her out of the show.
I kind of get the feeling that she's not going away anytime soon.
I hope she's gone, Professor.
I don't think so.
Okay, you know, there's a couple problems with this, and one of which is, and I don't know what the situation is, but, and I know they tried to write it in with a stupid line in Let's Kill Hitler, but she's looking really bad, age-wise. She is not looking good, you know? She was on the cusp, I think, of that age that people get where they start looking bad fast when they hired her for Silence in the Library. And, you know, she kind of convincingly, in Silence in the Library, she kind of convincingly came back like if they hired Nicola Bryant now and brought her back. And because that's kind of what it was. It's like it's a companion that has left you and later comes along. And,
well, it's like when they brought back Susan for the Five Doctors.
Well,
I mean,
she's gotta be older.
I recognized who it was, but it wasn't very convincing. And it didn't look good.
So, what's your take on the story? I've been doing all the talking, and Simon complains when I do all the talking. So,
I saw what Simon had to say on that. My take on
this.
So I'm
not talking.
Oh, great! Yeah, you're gonna throw it to the person who only got to see the episode once. And yes, I only got to watch it one time.
I'm just going on mute.
I did want to see it some more. My take on this episode. Do you just want a general impression?
I'm not talking. No. you can whatever you want to say about this episode. I'm
okay.
Fine.
Well, first thing, since the last thing you just talked about was River, let's start on this one. Moffat completely proved that the idea of the Doctor and River meeting in reverse order is rubbish.
Correct. We knew that, though.
We knew that.
We've been saying that for all along, and we've proved it again.
But this episode proved it.
They clearly have both moved forward from the last time they met.
Absolutely. Because how do we know that? Because she is now a professor. She has memory of past encounters. This was clear. So we can get that one out of the way now. The Doctor and River at this point at least have traveled forward, both in their relativistic time streams.
Do we want to – well, I'm interrupting here. I'm sorry. I was going to say, do we want to touch on the fact that the Doctor doesn't exist in the databases anymore, and so they let River out of prison?
That was going to be my next point. She got mysteriously pardoned because – she didn't do anything wrong. Now, okay, I'm just going to harp on the big thing. The big thing, I might as well, because this is all sort of related to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought this up in a previous episode. In fact, I brought this up with during various key episodes last
series six.
Yes, and that is cause and effect. Now, whenever we have a Doctor Who episode where time travel is merely the instrument to allow us to tell the story, fantastic. Great. No problem. I mean, we've got a whole history of magnificent Doctor Who stories to fall back on and prove that point. But whenever time travel becomes the core or a central element of the story, things tend to get a little weak. and this is one of them. I have a very hard time trying to reconcile the idea that all of a sudden, because the doctor no longer exists in databases, and we get this, I can only assume that as a result of what happened in Asylum of the Daleks, that the doctor had the bright idea to, and I find this one a little hard to believe, go all over the universe. How many hundreds of years did this take? And delete his existence out of every possible record throughout time.
I don't think that he got that idea from Oswin's attack on the Daleks, because he had that idea in, I don't know, Christopher Eccleston's Doctor did that to Earth. He gave the disc to Ricky and told him to run that virus and it'll wipe me out of all databases and all references in that. So this is something that he's done before, just perhaps not on a universal scale. But that doesn't erase him from, like, the prison warden's
memory. It doesn't erase him from people's memories.
So they're like, yes, Professor People Song, remember. You're in jail. And what does Professor Song do? By the way, who did I kill? Well, you killed the doctor. Here, look in the data. Well, there's no one in here. There's a big empty hole. It's just like in a – yeah, you're free. Well, I guess we'll let you go. I mean, go get a job. It is like when Oswin erased the Daleks' memory. I'm sorry. The Daleks, if they completely forgot the doctor, then they should be going, why are we here at this planet?
Uh-huh.
It's like, what brought us here? Why did we make those special Daleks to kill the doctor? Why did we do all these things? Because their whole motivational causal chain is gone, but it's not rewritten like Rory when he was erased from time.
Right.
They're just yanked out of a database. They should have a checksum error and go, I'm missing a memory here.
There should be a huge change in the time stream. Because as we've seen, thanks to Russell and still perpetuated by Mr. Moffat, the Doctor has now become this much, much larger than life character who straddles galaxies with a single stride. And
his
person
big blue box.
And his big blue box. And any
no,
person.
Ox. He's got a big blue ox.
Yeah. If we are going to take.
A police ox.
A police ox, yes. If we're going to take that idea and accept it, that this is who the Doctor is, and personally, I mean, I can accept it or not accept it. It doesn't really matter. I don't like it, but there it is. If you're going to take a character of that magnitude and scope and then remove him from collective memory, it's going to have enormous repercussions. And so now we've got Professor Song. She remembers, and don't tell me it's because she's married to the man, but
I didn't like that aspect of it too.
Yeah.
I mean, now they're all serious, like, oh, husband, oh, wife, oh, husband, oh, wife. It was all, oh, please.
Yeah, and last we heard, they really didn't get married because the doctor has to tell her his name, but he really didn't tell her his name, according to River.
Right.
He told her to look into the eye of the Tesselecta.
I do believe that the fact that they made her a professor was to preface that she's not going to be back. I think they're beginning to write her out because they're bringing her up to the point where she's about due to be gone.
That's possible. The only reason I kind of wonder is because, well, you know, and I don't want to jump to, well, okay, we'll jump to the end. The doctor invites her to join him on his travels. Yeah, I kind of get the feeling that that's not exactly the first time she's been invited.
Right.
But be that as it may, I mean, she may have traveled with the doctor for a good deal of time in a later regeneration. I wouldn't be surprised.
Or she may have traveled during those 200 years.
It's very possible. We don't know. I mean, it could be any possibility. But the fact remains is that River remembers. Other people do remember the doctor. I mean, if he deleted himself out of all time and space – at least, you know, out of every database, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're right. The people on the prison planet, they would remember why she is there. That she killed somebody. Just because you can't find it in the database, that's completely irrelevant. So yeah, I have a major problem with that point. I don't know if I want to get to the big elephant in the room until we get to one particular part of the storyline.
All right. Well.
But yeah, there was one big thing that I just watched and I just kept shaking my head at. I would say I do not accept the concept of this mystery novel, which, by the way, has been published.
Yes.
You can buy it. I know you can get it in England.
Yep. I know. They've got an ebook available as well.
I have not seen it, but I saw somebody on Twitter announce that they were – as soon as it was published, which was supposed to be any time, that he was picking it up. So I cannot accept the notion personally that just because Amy read a passage out of the book that the moment all of a sudden became fixed.
Yeah, I don't like that notion. I
personally don't accept
once it. Once I've read it, it can't be undone. But we do know that just because you've lived it, it can be undone.
I know.
In Doctor Who. So yeah. it doesn't...
Contradiction.
It doesn't make any sense at all. I don't like it. It's silly.
It's bad writing.
It's bad writing. It's a poor concept, and we've talked about it before, and it will... Every time they pull that trope, it's going to be crummy. Well, and I, you know, I watched it, and I admit, I watched it, they pulled out the book, and I said, oh, they're doing that again. And it wasn't worth the fight. In my mind, it just wasn't worth the fight to say, oh, here's that stupid idea again. I said, I'll just go with it.
But and, see, I can't. Because it is a central, it's a very
central
plot point.
Because you're more curmudgeon-y than I am.
Yes, I am. I'm far more curmudgeon-y than you. It is an essential point to what drives the characters further on in the story. Their actions are now dictated by what Amy may have read or may not have read in that book. And based on that silly, silly premise, it makes the actions that follow just as equally silly because they have no basis in anything that I think is intelligent.
Yep. I can't argue. It's a bad idea, and it's just a bad idea. It's not the worst idea.
No, it's not the worst idea. And it did stick in my craw, but okay. So I've said my piece on that, but I will have one other major to complain about later, but let us go on.
Okay. So I guess we should, to kick
we
a little
start at the beginning.
Start at the beginning. They're in New York. I think we said that, and they go back in time. So
actually, we should start even really in the beginning.
Oh, with the detective novel thing at the beginning.
Well, how
that hurt so bad because it's you know, when I watched this, boy, this is, we get like three Simon mentions in this podcast. He's going to have to come on and defend. I knew he would like that opening bit, and
I not because
he loves that Raymond Chandler-esque stuff. That's one of his things. So I saw that opening, and I thought, "Oh, he's gonna love this." And it, you know, it was put together well, but I haven't figured out what that guy Grail was hiring the detective to do.
That was a disappointment because it was not followed through very clearly. That bothered me. I had hoped that there would be something that would better link it into the rest of the story, and it didn't. So it started off great. It had my attention, and then it went away.
And it had no impact with our characters at all.
No, it eventually had no bearing. So yeah, it's another one of these elements, and we've had a lot of this throughout the series so far. You know, scenes that looked great when you first watch them, but when you give them repeated viewings, they don't stand up.
I mean, it's there to get you something before the credits, something dramatic, something angel-y,
yeah.
But it really had no bearing on the story, it doesn't hold up.
Repeated viewing.
Because you're going, okay, the guy knows where the angels live. Why is he sending the detective there?
I'd hope that there would be a better explanation. There wasn't one, so yeah. I mean, I know that if I had watched it a second time, I would have looked at that and went, "Oh no, that's a bad idea."
So when they're in New York, Amy's got glasses. They're reading the book. Blah blah blah. Rory gets zapped back in time by possibly a baby angel.
That's what it sounds
like. Yeah. How do they make noise? They had to rip a guy's throat out.
In order to
make noise.
Last time we saw them. And I also didn't exactly like the way that they were – the sound that we were hearing as they moved. Sounded like a little child almost. Flesh and blood cherub would have sounded like, but not a stone statue.
Okay, fair enough. It did have an organic sound to it as opposed to a stone sound. And I'm just going to go in here on the Weeping Angels before we get any further on the Weeping Angels, because as you know, we've talked, I think, about Blink at some point, and a thoroughly enjoyable episode of Doctor Who. And absolutely, the angels were not used to their – they were used frighteningly in Time of Flesh and Bone, but they didn't – see, and this is the other reason why they should never allow them to have two-part stories that just have separate titles. You know, we're referring to one story, and it's got – we got to give it two names, The Time of Flesh and Stone and Angels and Bones and stuff, because it's like they couldn't just call it Time of Angels Part 1 and 2 done with it. No, of course not. This is another thing I blame for Russell T. Davies on. In that episode, you can watch those two parts, and you can see that they've totally and utterly forgotten the critical piece of lore about the Weeping Angels. And they've forgotten it in this episode, too. Again. And yet, this time, they're playing with it more, and so it becomes more and more obvious. The Weeping Angels why do they weep? So they won't see each other.
They hide their faces.
If they see each other, they quantum lock each other.
Which they didn't blink, which was a great idea.
Except, of course, in this episode, they're looking at each other right and left.
Yeah.
Once they get, you know, one behind the other looking, then problem solved, eh? They forgot that part, and I don't like that. I think that, you know, the point of the whole – they're called the Weeping Angels for that very reason. They've collected Rory, but Rory and River, who's turned up now as Melody Malone, private detective who investigates angels. What?
Yeah.
What's that all about? I don't know.
Yeah, her the way she was landed in 1938, New York City, was very abrupt. I mean, just the way she was thrown into the story like that.
She's here because she is a vortex manipulator, but we never really found out why she was there.
That's the point. Why did she go there? We have no reason, no explanation.
And I don't exactly have reason to believe that she was there hunting angels, but Grail said something like the woman who hunts angels or something. So how would he know that unless that's what she's – it doesn't really matter. It didn't make any sense. But she and Rory gets blasted again by the little baby angels, which were very creepy.
Yeah, they were.
Very, very creepy. And the doctor, against all odds, with a temporal barrier in New York, smashes his way through yet another one of those stupid plot devices where he reads something that is said in the book and then figures out that he can go back in time to have something written on a vase, which ends up in 212 BC, or 221 BC, by the way.
That's in order to pass a message on to River.
221B, Baker Street, 221B, comes back. So it's on the vase so that the TARDIS can help them translate it so that they can see what they need to do. It's just like, I hate that. It was clever in the museum at the beginning of Time of Angels.
It was funny and cute then, but that gimmick, I mean, that's a one-time joke.
Well,
don't keep going back to
leaving, putting it in a flight recorder, and a flight recorder ends up in a museum somewhere, and over the thousands and thousands of years that the Doctor could be roaming the universe, eventually he might stumble across it. That gamble I can sort of buy, but to go have your message written on one vase and which then has to survive, you know, 2,100 years and be that precise one that ends up in that guy's collection. No.
Yeah, that was way too much of a long shot.
Way too much of a long shot. And so, you know, just silly and timey-wimey and nonsense and unnecessary.
But that's very Stephen Moffat. He likes to do these timey-wimey kind of things. I mean, all you got to do is look at episodes like The Big Bang. I mean, he loves to play that kind of flipping back and forth and really playing with cause and effect in a rather dangerous way.
Yeah. So the Angels have got this little hotel, Winter Key. What are they doing there?
It's a farm.
Yeah, how does that farm work?
Farm.
How does that farm work? Can you explain that to me? Because obviously Stephen Moffat couldn't explain it to me because he hadn't thought about it for 2 seconds or he'd realized that didn't work either.
The concept, which to be honest, I did not exactly get, but the concept is that they would keep zapping you back in time and continually feed on the energy, but I didn't get any evidence of that whatsoever.
Why did they need to keep them prisoner to feed on their energy? They don't need to do it in every other situation. They just zap somebody back and they fed on the differential between when you sent them back and the length of their life.
Exactly.
That's what it was in Blink. So they get the detective and they zap him back in time and they feed off his energy and all that's good. And the angel who fed off of him continues in her normal pathwards through time. So it's not like she gets to eat off of him again.
But that was the implication.
That's the implication, but it doesn't work that way.
It makes no sense. It does not work.
Plus, it also means they have to feed those guys for the 50 years that they are trapped in that hotel. How do they get food for them? Do they go shopping? They have a pizza delivery guy come in every once in a while and bring them some food?
Well, they have room service.
They have room service? Where does that come? I'm not getting any of that.
No, none of that made any sense at all, especially when we
– You're not getting two meals off the same guy. And you're in New York filled with millions of people. They don't need
to keep feeding off the same people over and over and over again. It made no sense at all.
They couldn't. They won't. They aren't feeding off the same people over and over again because they themselves are only feeding off the person when they zap them back in time. And if you think about it, the angel isn't going back in time. So he zaps the angel zaps the detective, and that's the only instant in time that the angel zaps the detective.
Yeah, because that angel's going to move forward along the timeline.
Their own timeline, that's right.
Yeah, the only thing that's going to happen is maybe that angel will experience a feeding again in its past. But yeah, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Well, okay, so the feeding thing doesn't make any sense. Because if you zap them back in time, I mean, if time behaves in any manner consistent with physics, you're going to have to require enough work to send them back in time to get the energy. Does that make sense? I mean, you have to expend enough energy to achieve
to get the
goal
energy.
And so you have to take it somewhere else. Anyway, do the angels have a sense of humor? Because what was in their elevator in their hotel? They had something in their elevator, which was just hilarious.
I don't remember.
Oh, I saw it when the guy, I think the detective at the beginning, it's like, ha, they have a picture of the Statue of Liberty.
Oh,
Mom.
That's right.
I don't know what the deal is there, but that was just bad.
I just kind of glossed over it. I mean, even though I knew the role the Statue of Liberty was going to play in this episode.
Yeah, which was
I just glossed over because that just seemed very typical of something you might see in a 1938 hotel elevator.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never been to 1938.
Well, neither have I, but I've seen a lot of movies.
I just never really thought that it would be a picture of the Statue of Liberty when you're in a building right next to the Statue of Liberty.
Oh, well, I have been to New York City, and yeah, I mean, I've been in shops where, yeah, the Statue of Liberty is, you know, there's a picture of it right in your, like, you know, you're just right next door
maybe.
To it.
Anyhow, so let's talk about the big, ugly bull elephant in the room, the Statue of Liberty.
Well, that's yours, not mine. Well, that's more yours. Mine comes a little later.
I mean,
how absurd is that?
I know that, you know, Moffat has said several times, and in fact, there was one posted on Doctor Who, official Doctor Who page today, where Moffat was in an interview, and he says, about a week or two after Weeping Angels Blink came out, people have come back to me every few days saying, oh, the Statue of Liberty could be a Weeping Angel.
No,
one,
it can't.
That's a dumb, I mean,
At some point,
why would you think that? The Statue of Liberty looks nothing like a weeping angel to start with. I mean, there are bazillions of statues out there in the world that look more like a weeping angel than the Statue of Liberty. I don't understand that one. It would never make me think of that because I just wouldn't do it. And then, of course, there's that whole, oh, if you're observing it, it can't move.
Well, and here is my other problem.
Yeah.
What role does it play?
It doesn't play any. It doesn't do anything.
It doesn't do anything. It just looks menacing when it shows up.
And presumably the reason it's looking menacing is because the people have heard the thing rumbling down the street. They've all come out their windows. They've looked at it. Now it's frozen. And what? They stop looking at it and it keeps walking away? Or
Yeah, that's plausible.
Not at all.
People just, oh, the Statue of Liberty has moved. Okay, I'm going back to sleep.
Uh-huh. Exactly. None of that makes any sense. And it's like, Stephen, don't listen to fans. Just don't. If somebody keeps telling you you got a great idea for a story,
don't listen
unless it's us.
Yes, listen to the smart fans.
Listen to us.
We know what we're talking
about.
When
we tell you what's wrong.
And this was big time wrong.
That was big time wrong.
It was a cheap trick. A very, very cheap trick. Very cheap trick.
And didn't advance anything in the plot. There's no difference from the Statue of Liberty standing there glaring at Rory than if an angel had showed up at the door of the roof, you know, coming off the stairwell. That's the exact same level of menace. Because a big Statue of Liberty angel is no more dangerous than a little angel.
Yeah.
Size doesn't matter.
I mean, what are they implying? That the Statue of Liberty will actually eat you physically?
I figured the Statue of Liberty is actually the queen bee angel, and she's got an egg tube down underneath Liberty Island, and she's just popping out those little chirrups when no one's looking, obviously.
Oh. Gnarly.
But then they also threw in the bit with the angels turning all the statues in New York into angels, and you know, that was kind of an add-on from Flesh and Time of Stone
and
Bone.
Yes, it was. That the image which beholds an angel becomes an angel itself.
That's not an image. So that one didn't make any sense either, but, you know, it didn't advance the plot. And it was, again, unnecessary. Just because the statue of the woman and the child became mobile and went after the guy and got him, they could have just as easily used an angel statue.
I think it was simply, well, in the case of the woman and the child, that was more to create possibly a sense of paranoia.
Terrify more children, too. And I'll tell you something. It scared the living poo out of my daughter.
The stone equivalent of Autons. Now you're going to be looking at statues, and you know, especially children, they look at statues and they think, I can't stop looking at it now. I have to stare at it for the rest of my life. I can't turn away. I can't blink. I mean, I think that's kind of where they were going with that. I don't necessarily have a problem if that was indeed the intent. Then I don't have a problem with the idea of, you know, the mother-child statue. But I have, again, I can't accept the Statue of Liberty because somebody at some point is going to observe it.
And it only needs one person to observe the Statue of Liberty standing out there in the harbor in the water, which I don't know how deep it is.
I don't know.
To be fair. So Rory, zapped back in time, comes to –
He's with Melody and
he gets separated again.
Well, he gets
he gets sent to Winter Key, and when he gets there
– explain how he gets sent to Winter Key.
Oh, the cherubs got him.
Yeah, but they didn't displace him in time. They just displaced him.
Yeah. For whatever reason. Maybe the little ones can't. Well, no, we got a little one got him and sent him back to 1938. So
I think that was to send him to Winter Key.
So goes in and guess what he sees?
Himself.
With a big nose. And once again, poor Rory has waited 50 flipping years for Amy. That poor guy. I mean, 2,000 years as a centurion. All those centuries inside the TARDIS waiting for Amy and the doctor's wife or whatever. You know, although that wasn't real. And now this.
Well, I think this is revenge for what happened in The Girl That Waited.
Yes, like she
waited. Yeah, because she had to wait.
And she didn't do it very well. But anyway. And, you know, he dies. So Rory dies. And the doctor's like, oh, sorry. Well, you've seen you die. So this is it.
Now it's a fixed moment in time.
It's a fixed moment in time. All the 50,000 other things I've done that have undone quote unquote fixed moment, but I've told you it's a fixed point in time, therefore it is one. And
they're getting really loose with the definitions of fixed points in time. What can be changed? What can't be changed? I mean, it's especially when in one episode they just made such a great point in establishing the idea that history could be rewritten. And that was something that Moffat made a very specific point about. And then now they're just getting just almost careless with, nope, you can't change it, you can't change it, you can't change it.
Time can be rewritten, but not unless – but not if you've read it. That was an interesting phrase. Time can be rewritten, but not if you've read it. It's like, well, wait. Well, how do you know it's been written if you haven't read it? So how do you know it's been rewritten if you haven't read it? So therefore,
and just because you've read it, why can't it be changed?
Yeah, and do you have to read it, or could instead of Amy reading it out loud and saying, and then he said, why did you break it? As opposed to that, what if she'd said, yeah, I read in the chapter about the guy, and then he broke an arm. It's like, is that good enough, or do you have to read it word for word? And what if they didn't remember it right when
exactly,
they wrote
they
the
told
book?
It wrong.
So they Melody got that part wrong. And
what if Melody deliberately decided
lied.
To change the facts?
Yes.
So again, this idea of these fixed points in time now, here's another story element which just falls flat on its face.
Yeah. So Rory has to run, because if the angels get him, he's going to spend the rest of his life alone in that room, because it's been seen and we know it. And Rory's going to run, and the doctor says, you can't do anything about it. And Rory and Amy go, wow, we're going to do it. And Rivers says, well, hey, it would create a paradox, and that might save the day. So off they go.
They jump.
Yeah, you want to – is this your big elephant in the room? Or
no,
is it,
no, actually it is. In fact, this is one of the strong moments of the episode. What I really enjoyed about this I've already started to make my case that I – really dislike episodes that rely heavily, that are timey-wimey, that really rely heavily on time travel, the nature of time, and how that dictates cause and effect in a particular episode. That's the negative. The positive about this episode is all Amy and Rory. I really, really grew to love these two as a couple. I found their evolution as a couple to be very strong. The fun little barbs that they threw back and forth at each other, and it was less about Rory being the henpecked husband. Because there's a great, very funny moment towards the beginning of the episode when they're in present day New York.
Oh, about her crow's feet.
Yeah, and she makes the crack that you're walking on, and I don't remember the line exactly, but it's something to the effect of, you're walking on fire, Centurion.
Yeah.
You know, but she said it with the tongue in cheek, and
yeah.
Rory then is usually, okay, I'll go off and get coffee.
Okay.
So the relationship between the two has become so incredibly strong, and they've done such a great job at over the seasons to really show how much love these two have for each other.
Amy as a companion has grown.
Enormously.
And that's a rare thing in a companion, and that's a good thing. Rory, not so much.
Well,
I've liked him, but he was kind of, apart from being jealous at the beginning, he was kind of fully formed.
No, I don't agree with that, because when we saw him for the first time traveling with the doctor in Vampires in Venice, he was the most irritating, annoying element.
Well, yes,
as a person
but
in that episode.
I think you would be. I mean, I'm not you personally. I mean, I think that the situation, and he was jealous.
No, of course he was jealous, but he was – but my point is his character was written as a complete and utter git. And we've seen this slow evolution. And the key for his development happened in the Pandora opens into the Big Bang, when, as the Roman centurion, he now has to wait thousands of years in order to be able to rescue Amy, and what that does to him, and that kind of, and I remember saying this when we podcasted on that, I kept saying he has got to remember that experience, because that is going to define him, it's going to change him and make him grow as a character. And it did. When we saw him in the Battle of Demon's Run, that was a character who would stop at nothing to rescue his wife.
Well, it's a character who's gained confidence, but
that's my point. He wasn't all that fully formed in the beginning. We've seen a lot. I maintain that we've seen a lot of growth and development in the character, and I have found that as the stories have gone on, that I've just grown to like him more and more and more, and he became incredibly strong. We saw that even in the beginning of Asylum of the Daleks, when he and Amy are just not getting along at all.
Pointlessly having that row at the beginning never panned out anywhere, did it?
No, it didn't pan out, but we still get a glimpse of a man who was no longer handpacked. He was no longer this little coward character who was always afraid that Amy was going to smack him.
Okay, I'm going to throw one thing out here, because there was one thing in this episode that when I heard it, I was taken aback, and when I listened to it again, I definitely think it was a miscalculation on Moffat's part. You were talking about their little banter and stuff going back and forth, but when they get up on the when Rory gets up on the ledge, and he's going to kill himself so that he can create the paradox that will save Amy and everyone. And he's up there and he says something to the effect of, if I do this, I die. Who else could do it except for me 2 times in 1 day? And, you know, tell me I'm wrong. And Amy weeps and cries and she couldn't do it. And he says, great, the one time you couldn't do that. And I thought, what a d**k you are. That was an thing to say to her at that moment. I didn't – it was meant as a glib line, but it didn't come off that way to me. That was one she should have slapped him and sent him over the edge.
Really? It didn't bother me.
I thought that was miscalculation.
I took it as a glib line because he's – at the same time –
well,
I mean,
you know, I'm just about to die, and
about,
I want to make you feel guilty about the fact that you're always telling me.
No, it's not that.
Well, that's what it comes off as, though.
It did not come off like that.
Well, you don't hang out with enough women, then. Because that you'd get a slap for a line like that.
No, I hang out with a lot of gay men, and believe me, we're just the same. No, what I got out of that is he intellectually understands what he needs to do. Emotionally, in his heart, he doesn't want to do it. I mean, who wants to, you know, any sane person doesn't want to willingly throw themselves off. I mean, it takes an enormous act to be able to do that. I'm going to save my girlfriend. I'm going to save reality. I'm going to throw myself off. So, but I think that in his heart, there was a part of him that definitely didn't want to do it. He wanted to stay alive. He wanted, and he needed Amy to give him that reason. And he did it in a very defensive – you know, a lot of people will fall back on humor as a defense mechanism. I'm a big one for on that one. And that was Rory falling back on his humor to
– I don't disagree that that was the intent. But sometimes you can say something as a joke and it
and
doesn't always play that way
but that's
to
how
the
I
recipient.
Got
so
that's how I received it.
Well, I knew exactly what he meant when he said it. It just was like, oh!
But I didn't receive it. I didn't receive it the way you did. When I heard it, I took it exactly in the way I felt it was intended. And it did not offend me at all.
Anyway, Rory and Amy do what?
Amy decides that she's going to jump with him. And this was a really great scene. I thought it was very well written. And this was the emotional scene that kind of pulled at me. I mean, did it make me cry? No, but I was very moved at the way the scene was written between the two of them and the jump. And I, to be honest, I actually thought that they were going to bite it, and that I didn't – if there was going to be any
kind
of –
It was close enough to the end.
It was close enough to the end that I thought, you know, maybe they will save the day, but I honestly didn't think that they were going to survive it. That's what I was expecting. And I figured that was going to be the big tragic ending. Amy and Rory doing this incredible self-sacrifice to save time, if you will. And, you know, that'll be the great tragedy. And their names will be written among the stars as for the enormous courage that they displayed. And so I was caught up in that emotion. And I'm sure that's where Moffat was going when he wrote that. That's what he wanted the audience to think when they were watching that scene.
Yeah, and he told people enough in advance, you know, there's going to be death. There's going to be death. Somebody's going to die. And so that is, you know, normally you would get up there and the companion would do something like this and perhaps jump off and you would know, well, they're coming back because it's Doctor Who and they've still got a contract. But in this case, we know this is their final episode.
You know, so
and Moffat's been saying they're going to die, basically. And you think, my gosh, maybe he really meant it. If it hadn't been for all that hype, and if it hadn't been for the fact that we knew it was the final episode, it wouldn't even for a moment have convinced you that they were really going to die.
Oh, heck no.
Right,
and,
see?
And so, a lot of that emotion would not – it would not have had as much gravitas as it did because, again, you're right. I knew this was going to be their farewell episode. You know, to be honest, even if Moffat had not hyped it, just the knowledge that this was their farewell episode added weight to that scene. Had we known nothing about this being their goodbye, I would have kind of – I mean, I would like, oh, you know, I like the fact that they're so in love with each other that they're willing to do this. But there's an escape hatch somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
There's an escape clause. You know, there's a loophole in this. And they'll come back.
Yep. And then that was just a double loop. They will come back for a moment. Then we'll kill them. The one thing I will say is I didn't like the falling scene.
It was cheesy.
Too slow. I don't like the slow motion falling thing.
And,
it's like
it didn't look like they're – I mean, obviously they weren't falling.
Yeah,
and so it didn't even look like they were falling.
It may look like they were floating.
I mean, they had been kind of like sprawling, you know, in midair. You know, that would have been a bit more believable. But it was done for romantic, poetic purposes, I assume.
Yeah. And like that.
to be honest, I didn't for either. I thought that looked a little silly. It took, and in fact, it actually took away, I think, from the scene because I expected almost to hear, you know, the theme from Love Story playing in the background.
I expected a big thump and an alarm, a car smash, and some car alarms go off. Of course, they didn't have car alarms in 38, but and so they wake up in the graveyard where they kept landing, and I think Amy said something like, why do we keep coming back here?
And
the doctor says, he said, it's causally linked somehow.
Yeah.
She said that.
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't remember, but okay, I'll accept that.
He did that when they – so they tried to get to 1938, and they bounced off 38, and they landed in the graveyard. And that's where they started from, apparently. And Amy said, why'd we come back here? And he said, it must be causally linked somehow. And that's when they pan away and you see Rory's headstone the first time.
Yeah.
And then they come back again to that graveyard. And I think somebody mentions it. We're at the graveyard again. And
Amy said that.
Yeah. And the doctor blows that off again. And you know, it's like, take family picnic and you and me and River and we'll go have a picnic at a pub and or whatever, and then it happens. Now you can tell them.
Must I?
Yeah. Because we've run out of big things for you to have the elephant in the room, so I thought this might be it.
Oh,
we might be getting close.
We're getting close to it.
Because there's not much left.
We're getting close to my big elephant in the room, but we're not there yet. So you can keep going.
Yeah, they zap Rory back and
Rory sees his headstone.
He sees his headstone.
And he calls Amy over, and now the doctor's completely all freaked out. Oh, we have a new fixed point in time. And then, boom.
No, he disappeared before the doctor
Oh, does
knew.
He?
Yeah.
Okay. Rory vanishes. There's one weeping angel left. Because the idea was that because of the paradox created, all the weeping angels in New York City are now gone.
I don't know that I got that.
I kind of did.
I mean, it was kind of like poison well, wipe out this place will never exist, but that doesn't mean that he's never really defeated the angels, and they didn't do anything with this angel either.
The only reason I get that is because Amy says, there's still an angel. Why is there still an angel? I do remember this.
He said it's a survivor.
It was a survivor. Which made no sense. I mean, if you're going to make this big deal about all the angels all of a sudden being wiped out, I mean, the paradox was supposed to completely eliminate the feeding farm at Winter Key.
And did, but...
Which would then, I guess the assumption would then be that the angels would not have existed up until the 20th or up until 2012. So, but you've got this one straggler who then zaps Rory back, and they take a look at his headstone, and now there's a death date because there wasn't one previously. It just had his name.
But
yes. Yes.
I have to go back. There was no death date on any of it.
Death date.
No, there's no death date on it. There's his age.
But now there's a death date.
No, there's no death date.
There was now.
No, there is not. I've watched the episode twice. It never has a date. It just says his age. Rory Arthur Williams, aged 82.
Well, okay. Well, that's a death date.
Oh, well, that's an age. Okay. Death date's March 5th, 1973 or whatever, but okay.
But my point is that now you've established his mortality. So,
yeah.
Death date. We know he dies, and you can calculate when.
I had kind of got that from the first time we saw the headstone with his name on it. That's usually an indication that they're dead.
But we didn't know when. There was no age on it. It was pretty clear. It just had his name. I don't remember seeing any age on it. There was a change when Rory went back in time. When he was zapped back, now we see a death age.
I'd have to go look at that. I think that if there wasn't one, it's because they cut the shot off, but that they cropped it out of frame. But
I don't think there was. I think Amy or Rory being zapped back in time is what establishes now his death. Because had he not gone back to take a look at that headstone, then there would have been no death date because he would not have been hit. He would not have been attacked by the angel. So it was still one of those things that's in flux. I mean, it might be his eventual gravesite, but it would be one for maybe, hundreds of years in the future or for a completely different, or who knows what. But the fact that he got sent back in time is what sort of locked his mortality in time in place. That's why the age then appeared. So now Amy thinks, well, if I allow myself to get zapped back in time, I will hopefully go back and I'll be sent back to the same time as Rory is. The doctor protests. He doesn't want to see it happen. River says, yes.
It's your best shot.
It's your best shot. Let her do it. So in a really very strange moment, when the doctor can clearly see the angel, although the angel doesn't move per se,
mm-hmm.
but Amy turns her back
mm-hmm.
and then gets zapped back in time.
Mm-hmm.
Why did she need to turn her back? The angel wasn't moving.
She's looking at the doctor.
We've never heard anything said that I don't think there's anything that's ever been established that says as long as you observe the angel, it cannot send you back in time. Maybe it's been sort of implied with the, don't blink kind of thing. But at least the doctor can see the angel, and River can see the angel. Yet it still manages to send Amy back in time when she turns her back on it. So that's a little questionable.
Well, if we're looking at it from ignore River for a second, if we could. The doctor can't see the angel because we're looking at Amy from his point of view, and she's completely obscuring it from his line of sight.
And even if the angel is not. Which I don't think the angel was, at least Amy has his full attention.
Yeah.
So maybe there's also some sort of cognitive.
Maybe the instant River blinked, then it. Or Amy just leaned back into it.
Maybe.
Or they just aren't very consistent with the way they deal with angels from one story to the next.
Oh, do you think that might be it?
I think it's door number three.
Yeah.
I do think it's door number three.
The angel then gets – the angel zaps Amy back and they take a look at the headstone, and now we see both their names and their ages, their death ages, on there. I seem to remember you had a – was it you that had an issue with the math on that?
No, no. My issue is the math on the year 2012.
Oh.
You know, we – but again, it's like those stories, dinosaurs on a spaceship, had to have taken place in nearly 2020 just based on their ages when they said. So, you know, Rory specifically says right in front of his dad, I'm 31 years old in Dinosaurs on a Spaceship. And they've kind of tried to make it sound like they've said it outright, explicitly, that Amy and Rory are aging faster than her friends. That's fine. That's a true statement.
Yeah.
But do you really think that they've spent 10 years entirely in the TARDIS?
No.
So, therefore, it's not 2012 anymore. It has to have been years have passed. I mean, we've gone through Amy's modeling career, her cologne stuff. We've gone through, Rory, you're gone for months at a time, and we really need you at the hotel. And a year of Power of Three, and all these things tell me that it's not 2012. It has to be beyond 2012.
Which would give credence to the line at the end of that episode. You know, the doctor says, you know, come along, you know, just go for an adventure. And Amy and Rory said, no. And that would have greater credibility if it is indeed in their future.
But anyway, you know, when Rory said in front of his – or to his dad, Dad, I'm 31 years old. I don't have a Christmas list anymore, right? Now, his dad would be very aware of how old Rory is. So Rory, who has to be basically the same age as Amy, and we know how old Amy is, or we know how old Amy was at her wedding. So his dad would have said something. I just can't help but believe that – if when I was 21 or 22 or 23 years old and I'd been talking to my dad and I said, Dad, I'm 31, your dad would look at you.
No, you're not.
And go, you're not. Right? He didn't blink. Brian didn't blink. He took it. Rory's 31. Rory is 31. Dinosaurs in a Spaceship occurred in the future of 2012. Had to have occurred in the future. All of that
had to
have
occurred. Which would then mean the Power of Three did also.
Unless, right, unless, so this story has to have occurred in the future, unless they went back in time to 2012 in the TARDIS, which just seems kind of weird.
Which I think they did.
It's possible, but it's just weird that they would pick 2012. You know, in that case, they specifically called it 2012. And I thought that was kind of odd that they finally fixed that down to a date and time.
And I think I think that does make sense, and especially the idea of, you know, this is an Amy and Rory from the future, because – and someone – I actually read this somewhere else. In the episode The Power of Three, there is a voice message for
Amy.
She's
getting her glasses.
She's getting her glasses.
Just before she goes off to – yeah.
And, you know, when you start to get older – you know, for most people – I mean, there are some people, you know, they wear glasses all their lives. But, you know, for most people, me – you know, once I got into my 30s, it's like, okay, I'm not seeing as well as I used to. So it only made sense that she would need to get glasses at that point.
And the doctor hadn't seen that before.
No.
So, or it seems like he hadn't seen it before when they got this episode. So I'm saying this occurred pretty much right after she got her glasses in Power of Three.
Yeah.
So
that's what I thought too.
This must be when they left after Brian said, go on, enjoy. So my question is, does the doctor go back and tell Brian, or does he chicken out?
Ooh, good question. Because I think that was sort of the condition that Brian gave the doctor, bring them back.
And he didn't. Here's what I would have said to Amy. She's there, you know, Rory's gone back in time to New York in 1938 or whatever it is, because his gravestone's here, and Amy's going, I've got to do this, doctor. Don't travel alone. And River's going, yes, this is your best chance. And the doctor says, Amy, there's too much of a paradox. I'll never be able to take the TARDIS to 1938 New York again. And Amy's like, I know, but it's okay. So the doctor says, take a train to Los Angeles and I'll pick you up. Oh, wait, that line's not there.
No, it's not. Or how about, wait till 1939.
Yeah, I'll come or by here.
Or I'll show up in 1937 and I'll just hang out and wait for you to show up. This is my big white elephant in the room.
Oh, okay.
Because the other sadness that this episode is built on is the Doctor's sense of loss. That he can no longer be with Amy and Rory. That he is now forever part of them. And I say nay to thee. That is not so. Just because he can't go back to 1938 because the timelines are all screwed up.
All he has to do is to get him back to New York by the time they're 82.
And I maintain that the timelines in 1938 are no longer messed up. Why? The paradox. I actually maintain that it cleared things up because the angels never existed.
Or the battery farm never existed.
The battery farm never existed. So 1938, the issue which prevented the Doctor from being able to go back into 1938, that doesn't exist anymore. So the whole paradox thing, no, don't buy it. Doesn't work for me. So he can't go back to 1938. Fine. Let's take that on its face value. That's not to say he can't go to he figures out when they're going to die. Okay, so I'll go visit them in 1948.
Mm-hmm.
Surprise, I'm here.
Let's go for an adventure.
Yeah.
Yep.
As long as I make sure to bring you back here, because I know that I'll create another paradox if I take you away and
out in space. It's like, well, then you can't, because you've already read your history and you'll die in New York, so you're fine.
Because it's a fixed point in time.
So you can't do that. We can't mess that one up.
No, but he can still go and visit them.
I know.
So that makes his sadness disingenuous. That entire ending of the story, the whole bittersweet ending. I mean, now, and I agree with you. It's a happy ending because Amy and Rory, we learn, live full, happy lives up until their death and when they get to be 80-something.
Yep.
And I looked at that as, okay, yeah, they die, but, you know, so what? We all die. Everybody dies. I mean, it's just a nature of human life. So just because we know that they're going to die doesn't diminish that happy life that they had living back in New York City.
We assume it's happy, but yeah.
Amy kind of implies that it is, because we find out that after Amy and Rory have been zapped back in time, the Doctor and River are having a little bit of a conversation, and we learn that River manages to get Amy in the past to publish this book that River has yet to write.
Yeah, but she might have – we don't know when she published it. So
we don't know.
So, I mean, it could have been like 6 months after they arrived back in 1938.
No, it's never made clear.
So they could have had a miserable life up to that point. But it does say his loving wife at the end. So they must have been together when the point Rory was 82, therefore.
I would imagine it is because of the River.
And we want it to be.
Well, we do. And the River tells the Doctor – I will tell Amy to write an afterword. And Amy does. And interestingly enough, in the beginning of the episode when the Doctor and Amy are in New York and Amy's reading out of the book, before they realize what it even is, the Doctor rips the page out, the last page out of the book, and he says, I hate endings.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, that is probably the most critical ending the Doctor needs to learn about. So after River tells him, maybe I'll get Amy to write an afterword, the Doctor's like, oh my God, he races over to where he threw the page. He finds it. He reads it. It's a very sadly filmed scene. He's all alone and you hear Amy's voiceover as he's reading it. And that's when we get the thought that, I mean, it sounds like it's, even though it's young Amy that we hear, we kind of get the feeling that it's older, much, 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 much older Amy, kind of giving a little bit of an afterward. He's like, oh, I had great life together.
I didn't actually take it as being old Amy, but I didn't. Yeah, it could be, yeah. I just took it as Amy at whatever point she wrote that. But now that you mention the whole thing, there's a little funny there too. So the Doctor takes a novel and he tears the last page out because he doesn't like endings. But in fact, he didn't tear the ending out of the book. He tore the afterword out of the book.
Yeah.
So if he'd been reading the book, he'd have gotten to the end anyway and seen the ending.
Mm-hmm.
So his strategy doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work. But we then get the happy ending. But this now leads to the one last big problem that this episode leaves us with.
I'm going to choose to say that it didn't really happen.
I hope to God it didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
It can't happen, because if it did, it changes everything.
Yep. It didn't happen. I think that's just, you know, Amy would not tell the doctor to go back and talk to my younger self and tell me all this stuff that I'm going to do, because she knows better than that. I mean, that's the whole fixed point in time thing again.
Exactly.
And
even though
I think we're just kind of looking at young Amy.
Young Amelia.
It's an artsy shot of young Amelia looking up and
she hears the TARDIS, or at least we hear the TARDIS.
We hear the TARDIS. She's looking up to the stars, and we know that she's got this future ahead of her. But I don't think the doctor went back and told her those things.
I certainly hope not, because if he did, the ramifications are disastrous. Because now the doctor is no longer a fiction or figment of her imagination as she grew up believing he was. When they finally are reunited in the 11th hour, she was referred to him as the raggedy old doctor who was just some crazy fantasy. And she relies on that specific memory in the Big Bang. And that's what brings the doctor back after he's been zapped into nothingness. Yet, if he goes back and tells young Amelia everything that they're going to do, everything that's going to happen, then her memory of him will have been altered. He is not a fantasy. He is now an actual real person.
Her imaginary friend who showed up twice.
Right. He won't be that.
Well, yeah.
He will not be the imaginary friend. He will be the real friend who's going to come back and take her sometime and take her away on some magnificent travel. This could literally spell the end of Doctor Who if he does that. I mean, he were to go back there.
The end of time itself.
Well, it would certainly be the end of him. I mean, it would have just terrible temporal ramifications if that's what happened.
Yeah, Melody will write a book and give it to the doctor, and that'll solve the problem.
Huh. Maybe.
They can just work their way out of that kind of timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly ball of stuff.
Yeah, but this episode had a lot of timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly stuff in it. And to go back to the question you asked me earlier, and that is, by digesting the episode and overanalyzing it, did it change my opinion? And I said initially, yes, it did. It made me actually appreciate the episode more. And that is true. I did appreciate the episode more.
Until we talked it through right now, and now
yeah,
you
now
hate
I hate it. I just absolutely hate the episode. it's just a terrible piece of crap. No, it's a fun romp. It is a fun romp. And if I keep my attention focused on this is really about just the pawns. It's about them. And if I just close my eyes and, you know, grip my teeth really hard and just pretend that all this timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly stuff isn't there, then this episode is great. And over the course of time, it is their adventure that I seem to remember.
Well, that's because the Doctor did nothing in this episode.
He was really kind of meaningless. He was ineffective. I mean, this is another case of Androzani. Oh, dear. That's going to piss some people off. I shouldn't have said that. Yeah. That's going to irk a few people.
It's not going to irk me because I think it's a grossly overrated episode.
Oh, boy, you're being nice.
With the worst score ever.
No, just bad. It's just bad. But it's the same kind of thing, though, where the Doctor, his presence really doesn't amount to anything.
All he does is get them to 1938 New York, and his explanations aren't even good. Rivers are better all throughout the story.
The only thing that he does, that any kind of pro-action, if you want to call it, that he does, and is more of a reaction, really, is how he uses some of his regeneration energy to revolution. Oh, you hated that, didn't you?
You're telling me that for all these years that the Doctor's been traveling around with companions and people who've been getting hurt and dying, and he could have just zapped a little regeneration energy into him to give him a little boost?
Well, I think the implication is that it only would work on another Time Lord. And even though she gave up all her regeneration energy to him at the end of Let's Kill Hitler, it's reciprocal in this case, that she could not have used that regeneration energy on anybody else. It could only work on a Time Lord because they have the metabolism, the physiology.
But she's not a Time Lord.
She still is. Just because she surrendered all that energy, all that means is she's
You're telling me she's got two hearts?
Good. Well, she's
I don't think she's
TARDIS.
I think she's a human that See, that's the question, and I don't know.
She's a child of the TARDIS, and I think that that's what makes it work.
And Miss Kevorkian did some stuff to him. But
yeah. I mean, if you would,
I just didn't like that scene. I thought that scene was kind of, again, it was pointless.
It didn't do really anything to advance the plot, and River gets – she ends up getting pissed off at him. Keith hated the scene. He found it offensive.
I did too. I just thought, cheap.
I just thought it was, okay, well, okay, fine, whatever. I mean, I just kind of – I just glossed over it. I either liked it or hated it. It had absolutely zero impact on me.
They didn't spend one iota of time looking through their diaries to find out where they were before they started talking to each other like their husband and wife.
They just
ignored the entire nature of the episode where we can't reveal spoilers to each other about stuff. And they didn't even bother to do anything about that.
Well,
they're just all husband and wifey.
Well, the only thing that we get we get two things, and that is
one. He started to say, "Where are we, Dr. Sung?" And she said, "Professor."
Well, no, but before that, right after she's pulled out and she's typing into her little wrist watchy whatever.
Vortex manipulator.
She says, "I'm texting a boy." And then you start to hear the TARDIS engines, and she tells what's-his-face, she says, "Just wait till my husband arrives."
Right, which I didn't like. And like I said, that didn't – you know, she's been playing this cagey the whole time. She didn't call him her husband when they met in Silence of the Library or anything like that. Of course, because she knows that every time they meet, they might be out of order. So she would never have – she just – you know, yeah, okay, she might have said it to Grail, but then Grail might have said it to the Doctor. And then that – you know, first thing out of his mouth, "You're her husband? What?" So that would have been a spoiler. And
well, the only thing that I can imagine is because she knew which part of the timeline she was contacting the Doctor only because of Rory.
Maybe.
That was the giveaway. She was able to look at him. She called him Dad. And he knew who she was. So there was no shock there. So she was instantly able to determine.
Actually, probably was a mistake on her part for calling him Dad. Just in case he was out of sequence.
That's true. That was very foolish on her part. But they did it anyway. So be that as it may, I can only imagine that from observing Rory, she was able to determine, okay, this is the timeline the Doctor is at right now. This particular moment is when I need to reach out to him and contact him. Because he's with Amy and he's probably trying to jump back in time and he can't, and he needs something like a homing beacon in order to do it.
That's why he sent the Yowza.
Which is, yeah, where I sent the Yowza. So.
But, yeah, I
but
didn't.
The line is, nonetheless, just wait till my husband arrives.
Yeah.
So we know where she is in the timeline. And then, of course, the big reveal.
I've been pardoned.
I've been pardoned. I'm now a professor.
Well, see,
and now you can. Well, I was going to say, now you can get all even further timey-wimey because we know in. Silence of the Library that, yes, indeed, she was a professor. She'd been made a professor. And then she discovers through a spoiler, so to speak, in Time and Angels, oh, I become a professor. So I don't know. Maybe you could say that that whole bit with the doctor erasing data banks and her being pardoned, was that also fixed?
Or she could have eventually gotten a pardon. Or
maybe
who
that
knows?
Who knows? All we know is that by the time we meet her in Silence of the Library, she is pardoned, she is a professor, and she is leading that team on some sort of archaeological expedition.
I maintain that that these two characters who cannot grow together because they meet each other out of order have clearly grown together all of last year. For the most part, they've kind of grown together. There is kind of in the middle, they're out of sequence again.
Well, things get a little weird in Demon's Run. That gets a little flaky.
I feel that the river that's with them in Impossible Astronaut is the river that's with them in the alternate timeline.
Oh, God, don't even put me down that alternate timeline.
Anyway.
And I hate that.
So, blah, blah, blah. This has gone on long enough.
But the point is that every time we start to get all timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly in an episode, this is what we end up with. We end up with something that kind of takes away what could have been an otherwise really solid and perfect episode. But a lot of the emotional development and a lot of the character-driven moments are based on these timey-wimey things that happen. And it's like a house of cards.
Mm-hmm.
If you build it on a weak foundation, the house crumbles. And the episode would have completely crumbled had it not been for the incredible love story of Amy and Rory. And that's what saved it. And that story element was so incredibly strong for me that I was able to – I wouldn't say overlook it, overlook all this negative, but I was able to walk away from the episode saying, not half bad. And that I rather enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll leave it at that. I actually meant we had to walk away from the podcast.
We've gone on quite a while.
Whoa, have we seriously gone on a long time. All right, people. Well, Doctor Who is over, and next week we'll have something different. But I don't know what it is.
That's
the way
that.
I like it. Because if I'd read about it, then it would be a fixed point in time, yes. All right. So, from me and Ben, I'll say good night.
Cheers.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast, a production of Lone Locust Productions. Join us on our new discussion forums at FusionPatrol.com. Find us on Facebook. Or follow us on Twitter, username Fusion Patrol. You can also send us feedback by email at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. If you'd like to support Fusion Patrol, please leave us a review on iTunes. Fusion Patrol's theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.